a special day for you, and we'll be dealing with that a little bit more in a little bit. You've already had your breakfast in bed, I'm sure. Oh, well. We thought about it. Let's put it that way. We appreciate Brother Matthews again leading the singing a cappella without the piano. We ask you again, remember to pray for Jan Ayers. Brother Merle's wife is over in New York City. Did I turn that on, Bill? Did I turn that on? There we go. She's over in New York City along with their daughter, Karen. They volunteered as nurses to go over work over there till July 4th. So they still got 7 weeks or so to go. So pray for them. If this continues on that long, that they'll be safe over there from everything that's going on. It's good to have you here this morning. Good to see you, Brother Jay. I've been praying for Brother Jay. He's had some very challenging health issues going on. Appreciate him making it. I just know that he could have easily stayed home today. I'm not saying he thought this, but I know with his health issues, it'd be easy to stay home. So I appreciate folks when they go that extra mile and get out there when it's hard to do so and know what that's like. So glad to have him. We'll mention this in the morning service, but pray for Danny Luskovich, Nani's husband. He fell last night and broke his kneecap last night. I forget what time she texted me about that, but what a thing to go on right now. And I'm not sure how, I think he's at home and they have to wait till Monday to go into to see a doctor or something. So he's at home with that. So pray for him, if you would, with that challenging thing. Brother Travis, if you'll help me this morning. We are in Proverbs chapter 25. We have been in Proverbs chapter 25 for 3 weeks. So if you're new with us this morning or just returning, you need one of these outlines. We do have everything filled in up to where we are now so that you will be caught up with us. But we are in chapter 25 of Proverbs and all the way down to verse number 19. Proverbs chapter 25 and verse number 19. We're looking at Solomon giving counsel, or the words of Solomon, counsel about those two. Beware of those to stay clear of. There are some folks in life that are toxic and you just want to avoid them at all costs. Sometimes you can't. You work with them. You live next to them or they're family members, but they're toxic and you just need to keep them at an arm's length. And that's what these Proverbs of Solomon are about. Again, in chapter 25 of Proverbs, we've mentioned this already. These are not Proverbs that Solomon penned himself. Verse 1 says, "These also are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied out." The first 24 chapters are those Proverbs that Solomon wrote with his own pen, his own hand. But King Hezekiah later on said, "That wasn't enough. I want more." What a good spirit to have. I want more. So he had his men go and collect the best of Solomon's Proverbs that had not already been recorded by his pen, and they put them in these chapters from chapter 25 through chapter number 29. So these are additional Proverbs spoken by Solomon, but recorded by the men of Hezekiah. As we're looking at those to beware of, we come again all the way down to verse 16 to 20. You'll see there, those we cannot trust, people who cannot draw the line. And then letter B was people who cannot desist from lies. There are some that just don't recognize the truth when they see it and couldn't speak it to save their life. I don't know if it was Mark Twain or someone in the past said, it's always best to tell the truth because then you'll remember what you said last time. If you make up a lie and then you have to get asked again, you have to remember what you said last time. But if it's always the truth, you're in good territory. Those who make false pronouncements was verse number 18. We talked about that. False witnesses can inflict terrible wounds. And now we're on the small number 2 there. Those who make false promises. And that is where we're at in verse number 19. Those who make false promises. Verse 19 says, "Confidence in an unfaithful man in a time of trouble is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint, or a broken kneecap, we might say this morning to understand it completely. Confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint. Those of us that have had a broken tooth, most people have experienced, if you've got any years on you, you've experienced what a broken tooth is like. That's not a pleasant experience. That is a very painful thing. Nobody wants to have a broken tooth. And the Bible says that confidence in an unfaithful man in a time of trouble is as painful and agonizing as a broken tooth. And a foot out of joint. Now, I've had a foot out of joint. If you've ever sprained your ankle, maybe not your foot, a shoulder or something else, a joint out of place, it is painful, it is agonizing. So I've had one, I've had the other. Thank God I've never had both at the same time. And that's what this is saying. It's not saying a broken tooth or a foot out of joint, but a broken tooth and a foot out of joint. This guy's in bad shape. And it says that a man in that condition is like that, a man that puts confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble. You want the other person in the foxhole to be as faithful to you as you are going to be to them. You want the other person in the foxhole, you want to be as faithful to them as you want them to be to you. Confidence in an unfaithful person is like a foot out of joint and a broken tooth. There are many biblical examples of that. I think of Jehoshaphat, who trusted Ahab. Remember when Ahab said, "Let's go fight together. Let's conquer the kings of the east." And Jehoshaphat agreed to it. Jehoshaphat, a good godly king. Ahab, a wicked king. And Jehoshaphat was gullible. And he followed Ahab into battle. And Ahab, and you read the story and you think, how in the world did he not see this? We can see it so clearly. Hindsight is 20/20. But Jehoshaphat, Ahab said to him, he said, "Let's go to battle together, and I'll tell you what, let's do this. I'm going to dress like a common soldier, and you wear the king's robes, and let's go into battle." Now, shouldn't Jehoshaphat have had a clue right there that things weren't going to work out good? And so they went into battle, and you know the story. The enemy had said, "Don't shoot at anyone, great or high, except for the king of Israel." Well, the king of Israel was dressed like a common soldier, and the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, was dressed like a king. So they cornered him, and they're all ready to shoot and fire till jumping Jehoshaphat cried out to God. And the minute he cried out to God, they said, "Wait a minute, that's not the language of Ahab. He wouldn't speak that spiritual. He wouldn't speak that holy." And they realized it wasn't Ahab, but Jehoshaphat. But Jehoshaphat almost lost his life by having confidence in an unfaithful man. The Bible also tells us back there in the Old Testament about when Babylon was coming down to invade the southern tribes, the two southern tribes. Assyria had already taken the northern tribes into captivity. Now Babylon was coming to take the southern tribes into captivity. Zedekiah was left there to be the king. And Zedekiah said, "You know, I'm in trouble because Babylon's going to come and they're going to wipe us all out. Nebuchadnezzar has allowed me to remain as king, but I don't think I trust him." And all of a sudden, Pharaoh of Egypt comes up and says, "You know, we can form an alliance here, and together we can fight against Babylon." Now, Jeremiah had told the king, Zedekiah, he told him, he said, "Don't put any trust in this Egypt, it's a broken reed." But he didn't do that. He trusted Pharaoh and allowed Pharaoh to come up into Judah to fight against Babylon. And the minute Babylon showed up, you know what the king of Egypt did? He fled back down to Egypt and left Judah all by themselves after they had rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had left Zedekiah there to be the king, but now that he had conspired with Egypt against him, he came, and you know the rest of the story. Confidence in an unfaithful man. Watch who you put your confidence in. Solomon's warning, those to beware of, those who make false promises. All right, those who cannot draw the line, those who cannot desist from lies. And then letter C, people who cannot depart from levity. Those who cannot depart from levity. Levity, of course, is laughter. It's a non-serious spirit. As he that taketh away a garment in cold weather. Now, who would do such a thing? Who would take away someone's coat in cold weather? That would be a cruel person. That would be a person without feeling. to rob someone in the cold weather of their covering. As vinegar upon nitre, and I had to look these up because I'm not a chemical expert. I know what vinegar is. It's kind of a cleaning product. It's got acid in it. And I had to check and see what nitre was, and I found out it's used in cooking and cleaning. But it is kind of like a soap powder, and vinegar is a liquid. And the two of them together, I found out, is effervescent. And so I had to look up the word effervescent to see what that meant. And it means, I remember this in biology class or in science class, chemistry, having a little test tube and putting two things in it. When you put them in together, each one separate was fine, but when you mixed them together, it bubbled over in that thing and you had to watch out for the acid that came over. Well, that's basically what he's saying here. Vinegar and nitre, they don't mix together. They don't go well together. So as he that taketh away a garment in cold weather and as vinegar upon a nitre, so is he that singeth songs to a heavy heart. There's times for laughter. There's times for tears. There's times for rejoicing. There's times for sorrow. I think of Job's three friends sitting around for 7 days with him as he was sitting in that pitiful condition. And as long as they sat around and kept silent and befriended him, they were fine. But the minute they opened their mouths, they got in trouble. Now, they really weren't guilty of levity. We might say that they did make light of Job's situation because they accused him of things that just were not true. But there's a time to talk and a time not to talk. There are times when you are sitting next to a loved one, or you get next to a loved one in the end of their days and their health is bad and you just don't know what to say. Times I'm at the hospital or the nursing home next to someone and their time is near and all you can do is try to be a comfort. It's not a time to tell jokes. And that's what this is telling us here. There's those that can't depart from levity. He that singeth songs to a heavy heart. The verse is Ecclesiastes 3:4. And it says, a time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. We need to be sensitive to folks that we're speaking with, talking to, trying to help. Understanding their situation, knowing whether this is a time to laugh with them. I enjoy laughing. I like to laugh. I like to laugh more than I like to weep. But there's a time for each of those. And you need to beware of those that can't sell, what's the word I want? You can't divide those. All right, they can't tell the difference between what the times are. A time to be quiet, a time to speak, a time to counsel, a time to mourn, a time to laugh. We need to watch, be careful of those who cannot depart from levity. All right, that brings us down to letter B. Letter A was look well to your fellows, those that your company, those that are around you. Look well to them. Then verse 21 and verse 22, letter B, look well to your foes. Look well to your foes. Verse 21, if thine enemy be hungry, don't give him a thing. He's your enemy. All right, that's 21st century theology. If thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. And if he be thirsty, give him water to drink. Number one, how to treat them. How to treat your enemies. Verse 21, looking well to your foes, if thine enemy be hungry. Now if it said, if thy friend be hungry, give him bread to eat, we would say that's not a problem. But if thine enemy be hungry, it's interesting again to note that this proverb, along with some others we've seen, are in the Old Testament. The Old Testament that many people say is harsh and hard. And yet Solomon himself is saying, if you've got an enemy and he's hungry, you feed him. Solomon had wisdom beyond his times. Because you know that the Lord Jesus Christ on His Sermon on the Mount said, love your enemies. Pray for them that despitefully use you. And here is Solomon back in Old Testament times introducing that same principle to us. So it is an eternal principle. It is in the Old Testament as well as the New. That you, when thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink. In the Old Testament, the Bible is full of examples of folks like that. Elijah and Elisha, if you ever studied the two lives of those two great prophets, they're both great prophets. But you talk about two different personalities. All right? Aren't you glad God can use different personalities? That God doesn't require a rubber stamp for everybody to be the same? How boring would that be? Now, it might be a lot easier to pastor if everybody thought the same way and felt the same way, but you deal with emotions, you deal with people and circumstances, so it can be challenging. But Elijah and Elisha, Elijah was the harsh prophet, calling down fire from heaven, slaying the 750 prophets of Baal. He was the man. He was the guy. And yet here he is, under a juniper tree, because one woman was after him, Jezebel. Isn't that interesting? As harsh as he was and as aggressive as he was, those with those dynamic personalities like that really many times struggle emotionally and spiritually with different things. Those that you think are on top of the world and they got the world down and everything's fine have struggles and have troubles. Elijah was like that. Elisha came around, his replacement. And Elisha, if it had been Elijah, it would have been a whole different story. I remember the time where Elisha, the king of Syria, was coming down and he was going to conquer the land. And he came down, he was going to kill the king of Israel. And yet every time he tried to trap the king of Israel wasn't where he was supposed to be at the time. And the king of Syria asked his men, he said, how does this happen? We set traps and he keeps getting away. And they said, well, they've got a prophet down there named Elisha. And he tells the king of Israel the things that you think about on your bed at night. He knows every thought you're thinking. So the king of Syria said, well, let's go get this prophet Elisha. And so they go down there to get Elisha. Elisha's not hiding like Elijah did. He's not under a juniper tree. He knows the king of Israel's coming for his life. He's in his house doing what he always did. And when the king of Syria gets there, Elisha comes out and speaks to him, and God smites him with blindness. Him and his whole army are smitten with blindness. And so Elisha leads the people of the army of Syria and all the men. He leads them down into Samaria, the capital of the northern tribes, the capital of the king of Israel. Now the king of Israel has his enemy and all those men right there, blind. He can go out and wipe out every single one of them. And he says to Elisha, my father, shall I smite them? Now here again, let's compare Elisha to Elijah. What would Elijah said? Go get them, boy. And we're not judging Elijah in that, but that's just his personality. Go get them. But you know what Elisha says? And he basically says, would you slay those that God has delivered to you into your hand? Would you kill them that have been given and delivered into you? You know what Elisha said? He said, make them sit down. Give them bread to eat. Give them water to drink. And send them back to their land. Now a lot of generals would say, that's a bad battle plan. When you got your enemy, you don't send them back because it's just a matter of time. But you know what happened? The Bible tells us Syria never again came into the land of Israel to attack them after that took place. You know what Elisha did? If thine enemy be hungry, give him bread. If he be thirsty, give him drink. And it all worked out just the way it was supposed to. How to treat them. Then number two, how to trust them. All right, you know how to treat your enemy. That doesn't mean you trust them. If a guy borrows from you $50 and he doesn't pay it back, and you forgive him, that's fine. When he comes and asks for $50 again and you give it to him, that's on you. When he borrows it one time, doesn't pay it back, that's fine. That happens. But when he borrows the second time, don't expect to get your money back. So you learn from experience how to treat them. All right, or how to trust them. And here he says in verse 22, for thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head, and the Lord shall reward thee. How do you treat your enemy? You treat them justly. You treat them fairly. Doesn't mean you have to trust them. But the Lord's not asking you to trust them. He's asking you to treat them. He says, for thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Again, look over at Romans chapter 12. As we know, that first principle in verse number 21 is New Testament because of Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. We also know that this principle is New Testament because Paul wrote about it in Romans chapter 12. And verse number 20. Romans chapter 12 and verse number 20. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. Now, I don't know if Paul is reciting and quoting. He doesn't say, as Solomon said, or as is recorded in Proverbs. But he simply writes the principle again. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Now, can I give you just a little bit of counsel here? If you're treating your enemy good, and in your mind you're saying, I'm heaping coals of fire on his head, your attitude is probably not what the Bible's asking you to do. Now, you're okay because you're doing the right thing, but also it's good to have the right attitude. And when you're doing good to your enemy, just do it because you're being obedient to God. You are heaping coals of fire upon their head. And the Lord is going to weigh this thing all out in judgment. But our attitude is simply to do good to those who would not necessarily do good to us. Look well to your foes. Then verse 23 and verse 24, we go to the last page of our notes here this morning. Verse 23 and verse 24. Look well to your friends. Look well to your friends. Help them. Verse 23, the north wind driveth away rain, so doth an angry countenance a backbiting tongue. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman and in a wide house. Look well to your friends. Warn them, advise them of those to whom to beware. It says in verse number 23, the north wind driveth away rain. The blowing wind is number one. Look well to your friends. The blowing wind, the north wind driveth away rain. This is a meteorological, that word. It's a fact, all right? The north wind driveth away rain. Job said in Job, or Elihu, said in Job 37 and verse 22, fair weather cometh from the north. All right, those of you in Buckeye Land, you can be thankful. Our good weather comes from that state up north. Isn't that good Bible teaching? All right, fair weather cometh from the north. The north wind driveth away rain. When there is rain, the Bible tells us that the north wind drives it away. So doth an angry countenance, a backbiting tongue. Now, it's true, isn't it? I don't necessarily like that, but it is true. And I know I've used that in raising my children. There's times where just a stern look was all that was necessary or needed to get them to do what they needed to do. And so an angry countenance will turn away a backbiting tongue. In other words, when you meet that gossip, when you meet that critical one, that person that likes to tear down and not build up, don't converse with them. Don't give them any time. Give them an angry look. That's what Solomon says. That's the proverb of Solomon. Solomon, give them an angry look. Now, it doesn't say to get angry. It doesn't say to blow up at them. But it says just to give a disapproving glance to let them know you're not on board. You're not going along with this. As the north wind driveth away rain, so doth an angry countenance, a backbiting tongue. Then verse number 24 is a verse that we're familiar with. I'm not talking about from practical experience. I'm saying we're familiar with it because it's already been stated in Proverbs 21. It says, it is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman and in a wide house. Look back at chapter 21 to show why I said that. Twice in chapter 21, Proverbs, Solomon said the same thing. Again, these Proverbs are others recorded, but Proverbs 21:9, it is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. And down in verse number 19, it is better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. Solomon's proverb giving counsel and advice against trying to make peace with a woman when she's angry. I'm not going to touch on this one for very long at all, especially on Mother's Day. They asked the henpecked husband, "Have you ever considered divorce?" And he said, "No, but I've considered murder." Okay. It is better that we're moving past this one really quick. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. Solomon had 1,000 wives and 300 concubines. Can you imagine? I guess he would know. There were those that were angry, those that were contentious, those that were mean-spirited, those that were mad. He had a bunch of idolatrous wives that came from foreign countries and foreign lands. Can you imagine that household? So he knew of what he was speaking when he said, it's better to dwell in the corner of a housetop. Again, they had flat roofs back then. He's saying, it's better for you to curl up in a fetal position over in the corner than to try to live with a brawling woman in a wide house. Look well to your friends. And finally, verse 25 to verse 28. Look well to your feelings. Look well to your feelings. As cold waters to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. Look well to your feelings. Verse 25 and verse 26 is the king's position. The king's position. A righteous man falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring. The king's position, letter A, when good news comes. As cold waters to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. Cold waters to a thirsty soul. That's refreshing. We talked last week about the wealthy man that would get the snow down from the top of the mountains to put in the drink in the time of harvest, when a man was working so hard and sweating so profusely, and then to be delivered a nice cold glass of iced tea or water or whatever it is. Well, here it says the same thing. As cold waters to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. You can be refreshed by good news. In the Bible, Jacob had thought he'd lost his son Joseph. Thereafter, he thought he'd lost his son Simeon. And now he thought he was going to lose his son Benjamin, because his boys were about to go back to Egypt where Simeon had been imprisoned last time. And now the second highest of the Pharaoh in Egypt had asked for Benjamin, the youngest, to be brought back. And Jacob just said, "All these things are against me. Joseph is gone. Simeon have you taken, and now you'll take Benjamin. All these things are against me." Jacob was old before his years because of his suffering, because of his agony. Now there's a lot more backstory to that. You remember Jacob, whose name means deceitful, and what he did in his earlier days, and now he's just reaping for that which he sowed when he was younger. But nonetheless, here he is at this point in his life, living in the land of Canaan, but not enjoying the land of Canaan. I always found it interesting when he sent his sons to go to Egypt for food. He packed them up with figs and raisins and this whole list of stuff. And I thought, well, there's enough to live off of right there. And yet he sent him with all these things to go down and get proper food, I guess, from Egypt to get down there. And then as things transpired, here he is, ready to go down to his grave without Joseph, without Simeon, and now giving up Benjamin. But you know the story. The boys go to the land of Egypt. Joseph reveals himself to them. Those boys jump in those carts and go back with all kinds of goods, laid it down in all their wagons. And kind of like the prodigals returning, the father sees them from afar off. And when they get there, their first words are, "Joseph is alive." And after that, you read about Jacob being young and spry like he hadn't been up until that point. Something happened to Jacob at that very point that just refreshed him. What was it? Good news from a far country. Joseph is yet alive. We don't experience something probably to that degree, and yet it's the same thing. When we get that good news, it is refreshing. When good news comes, letter B. When grim news comes. A righteous man falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring. The righteous should never have to fall down before the wicked. The righteous should never have to acquiesce or give way to the wicked. And yet it is a truth of history. There have been times over and over again in history where the wicked have prevailed over the righteous. In Christian history, those that have been martyred for the cause of Christ have been killed by Christ haters and set to their heavenly reward when they were righteous men and unrighteous men were condemning them. It is just a way of natural history. I've got a story here, and I tried to read it in such a way I could communicate it without the information, but I'm just going to read it, and I hope it doesn't make it dull, but I want you to think about this. The right person bowing down before the wicked. Galileo. You'll remember that name probably from history, though if you're like me, you know the name, but you have no idea what he did. So I'm going to read it. When he was a 17-year-old medical student at Pisa, he noticed that the chandelier hanging over the altar in the cathedral was swinging. Typical 17-year-old, not listening to the lecture, watching the pendulum swing above it, all right? He observed something never before noticed. Although the length of the swing was slowly decreasing, each swing took the same amount of time. Each swing was shorter and slower. The decrease in speed was compensated by the decrease in distance. Galileo had discovered the law of isochronism in the pendulum. 17 years old, that's pretty good. Galileo switched his field of study from medicine to mathematics. He was tutored in the subject for only a short time, but his keen mind went on to master Euclid and all the mathematics known in his day. In fact, Galileo became a lecturer in mathematics at the University of Pisa. From the famous Leaning Tower of Pisa, Galileo demonstrated another principle of physics. He dropped two weights simultaneously. One weighed 1 pound, the other weighed 10. Both weights hit the ground at the same time, disproving Aristotle's theory that a heavy body falls faster than a light one. Galileo figured out that an object, regardless of its weight, falls 16 feet the first second and 32 additional feet in its succeeding second. He went on to discover the basic laws of motion and to invent the thermometer. Pretty smart guy. Then Galileo heard that a Dutch lens maker, Jan Lippershey, had invented a telescope. Galileo worked out the optical theory that made a true telescope by mounting lenses in a tube. He went on to build a telescope that had a magnification of 30 diameters. Then he turned it toward the moon and saw its mountains and valleys. Galileo began to study the sun and the stars. He challenged the old Ptolemaic system, which postulated that the earth was the center of the universe and the sun moved around the earth. But the Pope forbade him to teach any such theory. The Roman pontiff sat on his throne in St. Peter's and pronounced ex cathedra that the sun went around the earth. This infallible decree was signed by Cardinals Faria, Guido, Desiderio, Antonio, Berlinguero, and Fabricio. It read, "In the name and by the authority of Jesus Christ, the plenitude of which resides in his vicar, the Pope, that the proposition that the earth is not the center of the world or universe, and that it moves with a diurnal motion is absurd, philosophically false, and erroneous in faith." All that Galileo had discovered, the Pope said was not true, because it contradicted what was popularly accepted at the time. In 1632, Galileo published his most famous work, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, and brought down the wrath of Pope Urban VIII. So Galileo was summoned to Rome and tried by the Inquisition. On June 22, 1633, in order to escape a cruel death, Galileo was obliged to fall on his knees and sign a retraction. "I abjure, curse, and detest the error and heresy of the motion of the earth." Isn't that interesting history? But the Pope did not have the last word. As Galileo rose from his knees, he muttered under his breath, "This will not prevent the earth from moving." He gave outwardly and openly, he bowed before the wicked. He that was right, and we've discovered since then or known since then that he was right, but he was right, but was made to bow before the wicked and to save his life had to retract that which he knew which was right, though in his heart he didn't do it. A righteous man falling down before the wicked is a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring. Verse 27. The king's pride. It is not good to eat much honey. Now we know that honey is good because Proverbs already told us that back in verse 16. Hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee. But it says it's not good to eat much honey. So for men to search their own glory is not glory. Time prohibits us. We just got a minute or two left. But if you go to 3 John later and look at 3 John verse 9 and 10, you'll read about a fellow named Diotrephes. And in 3 John, John is writing about this fellow Diotrephes who opposed him. John. John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. All right? He opposed him. Now that's not a good thing to do. He opposed him in such a way that when John wrote a letter, first of all, to Gaius, Diotrephes came across it and destroyed it so it never got to him. So John had to write a second letter and try to bypass Diotrephes, who had made himself the head of the church and had excommunicated anybody that had loyalties to John. If you like John, Diotrephes didn't like you, because he didn't want you to like someone who walked with the Lord and ministered with the Lord and took the Lord's mother in after he was crucified. He was envious and jealous, and he went against anybody that befriended John. For men to search their own glory is not glory. Then finally, number three, the king's passions. He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. One that cannot control himself, his passions, his desires, his lusts, his attitudes. The Bible says if he has no rule over his own spirit, he's like a city that is broken down and without walls. Look well to your feelings. Guard your heart and your mind and your attitudes. Those are the words of Solomon, and Solomon in Proverbs chapter 25. Father, thank you for our study of Proverbs 25. We pray, God, again, that you'd help us to take these practical lessons to heart and to put them into application in our lives. Bless our morning service and those that come to join us. In Jesus' name, amen. We'll take a short break and then begin our morning service.